What's up, Bry Guy? How you doing?
I'm hanging, man. It's good. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to do a little Q&A. Some of this stuff is about hybrid training. Some of it's lifting. Some of it's a little bit out there. I think we have some good questions. If we go rogue on some of them, I think that that's fine. This person, okay. I'm gonna start with this question. This person asked this question when I had Danny Matranga on last week, and it's the same exact question. And I kind of like the question. Kind of back to back. So the first one is what's something on the fringe that you do / believe in that there isn't like amazing evidence on, but you're like I believe in it enough to do it. And my answer, I'll just give you a second to maybe think, but my answer last time with Danny on was I wear blue light blockers at night, and I will happily like kind of shit on people who are wearing them during the day, like biohacking videos of people mm-hmm. like that lady who wears them 24/7 in her videos. Like, yeah, okay, you're kind of an idiot if you're wearing them during the day, but yeah, that is actually something that I find tangible benefit from, you know, post 8 p.m., dark red glasses. So I won't give that same answer, but yeah, that's something that's like kind of on the fringe. Not really sure if I could like pull up 1,000 studies that are make it like very much worth your while, but I throw it on the pile of things that like I think if you're working on sleep hygiene might be worth, you know, a small purchase to give it a shot.
Yeah, that's a great one. I feel like a similar level of fringe would be just nasal breathing. I feel like there's enough research out there that basically says it doesn't make a difference. But there's certainly some that says it makes a profound difference. And there's a lot of people in the camp of nasal breathing that is that are very convincing with the way that they speak.
In what context?
Patrick McCown and what?
In what context? Like overnight sleeping mouth taping or during exercise mouth taping?
Just in general, I think. Like just breathing through your nose as opposed to your mouth in anything throughout the day or night, I think is a somewhat questionable research topic at the moment.
Yeah, that's fair. For fun, would you care to give a theoretical, optimistic reasoning as to why one might get some perceived benefits? You know, put a lot of caveats in there, but like if you had to sell somebody again, it might not even be your point of view, but if you're like, yeah, that might be maybe even a small part of thing, and that's why I might, you know, take a flyer on it.
Yeah, I mean, like my personal anecdote is that I started focusing on nasal breathing when I was 39. So like not even 3 years, like almost 3 years ago, and primarily at night with the mouth taping thing, and then through zone two exercise now, which is consistent across every zone two workout that I do. And anecdotally, I think that it has created a better mental state, more clarity, focus throughout the day. At first, I think it had a pretty dramatic positive impact on my sleep. And now I'm not sure that I'm necessarily sleeping any better now that I've sort of adapted to nasal breathing as just the way that I take air in. But I certainly wake up feeling refreshed in the morning, and I don't know that I necessarily did before, but as far as like number of wake ups and disruptions, I think it's similar. One benefit that I've found for sure is that through prioritizing nasal breathing when doing zone two is that it opens up the nasal cavity and makes it easier to breathe through my nose at other times throughout the day and at night where it was a bigger challenge before. So I think there's something to, I've heard someone refer to it as lubing up the nose in there by getting all that airflow under duress passing through the nose. It somehow like clears it out a little bit. So I would say that's probably mine. I think looking at the research, the way I lean toward it, and maybe it's just because of my bias, but I see it as there being a slight benefit across the spectrum of nasal breathing. But I've found enough research as well that basically shows no difference. So in some ways, maybe it's like the difference between training at like 1 or 2 to 3 RIR and they're mostly the same, you know?
Yeah. I like the nasal breathing as just yet another loose subjective proxy of being in zone two. I think it's not so clear. It's like, well, if I can't nasal breathe, I have to mouth breathe, then I'm definitively out of zone two. It's not that definitive, but it is something to the effect of like, well, if you literally cannot maintain nasal breathing and you like absolutely have to open your mouth and breathe, you know, that's sort of, you know, you could put that on the pile of proxies of whether or not you're still in zone two. I've used it for that for that purpose while I'm in zone two, just as like a, can I keep nasal breathing during this? And again, it's not so clear that that is a fine line, but it is, you know, one of many things you can use to decide if you're training, you know, over the intensity you'd like to be.
I feel like I'm, because I've trained nasal breathing, I can get into zone three, zone four and still be nasal breathing. It just sounds different and the speed is different. And so the proxy that I really like to use is now respiratory rate, regardless of whether you're in the mouth or the nose, like how many times in a minute are you breathing? And so when I'm in zone two, I feel like I should be able to be at 15 breaths a minute is about my zone two place, which is 2 seconds in, 2 seconds out for 15 breaths pretty consistently.
Where are you getting that data?
What?
Where are you getting that data? Are you getting that in real time?
Yeah, I'm literally like looking at the timer on my phone and then I'm counting my breaths.
Gotcha. I wasn't sure if there was you were wearing something that was giving you that feedback kind of like next to your heart rate somewhere, because respiratory rate, that would be a helpful proxy. Yeah. I guess you could do it.
Yeah, that would be sweet if you had like an automatic respiratory assessor on your device for sure.
Yeah. Cool. Nice. All right. And kind of a parallel question, same person. I kind of enjoyed this question, but something... you could pick either or. Something that you know you should do because it's likely good for you or definitively good for you that you don't do, or something that you know isn't good for you that you do anyway, and you can't say pot.
Damn.
That was Danny's answer too. As I was reading it, I was like, he can't say pot. So I'll give you a chance to think. The first one is something that you think you should do that's likely good for you, but you don't do. And for me, it's any form of mindfulness. And what I mean is like, I don't meditate, I don't journal. And I've gone through periods where I love headspace or love certain different journaling practices. And I will have, if you've caught me on one of those like waves, like one of those peaks, and I talk about it then, like I'm probably super into it, but my consistency is incredibly shoddy with any of that. Mm-hmm. I do go to therapy once a week, and I feel like that is a large bolus of mindfulness that replaces, at least is my rationalization, replaces the drip fed more frequent, you know, small doses of meditation or journaling, which I bet you, you know, Jenna and I got into a really good spot with that. We would actually do it together. It was like, even if it's just like 3 to 5 minutes, and I really did enjoy it and I really think about it, but there is something about the proof is in the pudding. It's just not something I keep up with. And there's an argument of, oh, you're the exact person who should keep up with. It's like, all right, cool. But like, it's not something that I end up subconsciously thinking is worth my time after a block of being really consistent. Like you'd expect after a block of being consistent that it would become clear that this is worth your time. And after multiple blocks of time, it has not cemented itself as a habit. So I don't necessarily know what to do with that information, but it does feel like, you know, things are pointing in the direction of like, maybe that's not for you per se, maybe at least all the time.
Do you do any sort of bringing attention to your breath at any point throughout the day? Like it doesn't even have to be a meditation per se, but like, you know, sometimes I'm on the computer and I'm like very sporadic and I can almost feel that like my blood pressure is rising and my cortisol's up and I'm just like, okay, shut the computer, focus on my breathing for like 2 minutes in and out through the nose, et cetera, very calming. And then I can kind of like feel different going back to the computer again.
I don't, but I see that sort of, again, calling it meditation, calling it breathing exercises that, again, doesn't have to be a lot of minutes. I see the value. Like, we're talking about it now, and I'm like, yeah, it's a good idea. I could totally do that. I do think lowering the bar is a good idea, though. So even just being like, hey, putting on a two-minute timer and you know, again, after 900 years and 8,000 apps, like, being able to, like, get into the state of paying attention to breath is at least a skill that I feel like I have. So maybe just lowering the bar is a good thing for me. Maybe it's, like, 1 minute.
Yeah.
Once a day to start. It's like, can you do that for 1 minute? I think that's not a bad place to start.
Yep. Cool. All right, cool. Well, I have an answer for both of those.
Hit it.
So I'm not going to give you either. I'll give you both.
Nice.
I should eat more vegetables, but I don't.
What's and your rationalization? Can you give a rationalization? I can, because that's actually a great answer. I could also piggyback on that, but do you have a rationalization for that? Or is it, I just don't like it?
I mean, what it boils down to is that it's extra preparation for something that I don't really enjoy. And so it's really easy with both of those two things in order. Like if the preparation was really easy, it would hit one less barrier, but I don't love like frozen vegetables. I definitely wouldn't eat canned vegetables. And so for me, it's the process of preparing them, either roasting them or steaming them or grilling them or whatever it is. And it just becomes another thing that I have to do.
Yeah. Do you find that you compensate? So my state right now is I eat vegetables at max once per day. And that's usually asparagus thrown in the oven for an arbitrary amount of time, just like with some olive oil, whatever. But my compensation is that I eat a lot of fruits and a lot of seeds and a lot of, you know, if my goal is fiber, micronutrient, antioxidants, I'm getting enough of all of those. You miss maybe like unique phytonutrients and stuff from plants for sure. But my rationalization, once I realized that I probably am not eating as many vegetables as I would recommend somebody eat, my rationalization was to overcompensate with fruits. And I just like decided, hey, you know, no more like eating just the same 2-3 fruits that you like, you know, we're going anywhere from 5 to 10 different fruits on rotation in the house from a diversity standpoint. And I don't think that is the same as just eating a bunch of vegetables. That's been my, you know, rationalization compensation the last couple of years.
I do the exact same. Yeah. I overcompensate with fruit. I love fruit. And I also eat between 5 and 10 different fruits at any time. I try to eat them seasonal. So right now I'm eating primarily summer fruits, which are my favorite, like cherries and golden kiwis. Those just beet, peaches, apricots, those really crush for me. So I'm in heaven. And then I do try to get fiber through nuts and a lot of whole grains and potatoes and stuff like that. So I also feel like I'm getting fiber and I'm getting the nutrients. And I take my Legion multi code, Brian, don't use Jordan's code. So anyway, that's the one that I should probably do more of. And the one that I shouldn't do is drink as much water as I do after 5 p.m., 6 p.m., whatever kind of cutoff you want to put on it. I would say I'm really good about stopping after 7 p.m., but I'm still having the issues that you would expect to have if you're drinking water up until bedtime. So I think I need my cutoff to either be earlier or I need to not have large boluses of water with dinner. That seems to be the thing. It's like it's a guilty pleasure where I want to chug water when I'm eating food. And so I'll go through like almost a liter of water at 6 p.m. And then even if I cut it off at 7, it's like, who cares? I already just drank a liter like 3 hours before bed.
Yeah, that is a good one. I think people see that as like when people think about having poor sleep, they think about something being wrong, right? Like I'm overstressed. I got cortisol dysregulation, or you know, I was on my phone too late. And it's like just trips to the bathroom can be something that is not. I don't want to be hyperbolic. It's wrecking your sleep, but like, it's, you're not sleeping when you should be sleeping. And in my older age these days, Jenna's going to crack up if she hears me. Like you could look at me and I think she would say you have like some slight OCD tendencies with going to the bathroom before bed. I cannot have any sensation of needing to go to the bathroom, or I'm going to get up and go to the bathroom. So if I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm just like tossing and turning, if I even sense a remote sensation that I need to pee, I get up and go to the bathroom. So it turns out like 4 or 5 times a night, you know, and that's just like not great. And so, yes, and I had another thing is we had a boatload of watermelon the other night because we had to finish it. And I didn't realize like how much water was probably in there eight. And I was like, oh my God, I was peeing like 5-6 times that night. So yes, drinking water is good. Dear listener, please, 99% of people should be probably drinking more water, but you know, something to be said about if you're getting up frequently at night, maybe front loading that a little bit more.
Yep.
Cool. Nice. All right. I closed out that tab. Where are we? Here we are. Okay. It was a cardio hybrid one. What is the biggest mistake? Or we can just go through some mistakes. What are some mistakes beginners are making when it comes to hybrid training? I think, I don't know about you, but just like calling it hybrid training is already like, whatever. I'm fine with it. But it's just like, you're just like, all right, like I'm doing some cardio and I'm lifting.
You know, what's like, the better word, concurrent or what?
No, hybrid is the better word. Hybrid's a better word, but yeah. We've given, whatever. Hybrid is, things need names, so we don't need to fully explain things, but I just like, so someone's like lifting 3 days a week and they like do one day of like incline walking. Like, is that, are they now hybrid training? Or are they just like also doing a thing that's good for them? So whatever.
Right.
Let's say somebody's.
Are bodybuilders in prep?
Yeah.
Like, are walking on the treadmill every day. I'm hybrid.
Totally. So let's pretend like it's a cliche person you and I might come across, which is like somebody who's, you know, caught the hypertrophy bug and is, you know, now finding out that, you know, the cool hot thing is to also not suck wind going up the stairs and wants to do some cardio. And so what are some mistakes that people are doing, let's say, with implementing cardio on top of their weightlifting, let's say?
Yeah, I think it could go one of two ways with this answer. It could go either polarizing ways, but either doing too much intensity or not doing enough intensity. I think at a point, it doesn't matter. Like when you're a raw beginner, it's like, hey, you're probably doing it 2 to 3 times a week. Like you probably should go hard each of those 2 to 3 times because, hey, you're new, newbie gains, all that stuff. So you could make a mistake as a brand newbie by basically being like, I'll just do 3 like walks thinking that those are accomplishing something for you. And if the walking is hard, then that's great. Like that's what you should be doing. But if the walking is really easy, maybe you should be going a little bit harder. And then it could go in reverse too, where you are just not doing enough intensity to begin with at all. Or you're doing too much as you continue to progress. So like once you're no longer a newbie, I think doing too much intensity becomes a problem. Doing running without great form, I feel like could be a problem. It's tough to, so this question I feel like changes when it's like a brand new person that's just starting out first time versus somebody that you're like, hey, you're a few months in, like you're pretty conditioned. Because I would say there's probably a point where you start needing to concern yourself with how close you might put your intensity sessions to your leg days, like on the same day, on the day before, day after, versus keeping them 2+ days apart. So there are considerations that mount in importance as you go. But I think right off the bat that it would either have to be mismanaging intensity or mismanaging volume. Like just you, people that get so gung-ho right off the bat that they're like, I'm going to start running 6 days a week from the couch, you know?
And I also think that the modality changes the discussion as well. Because if you're like, it's a less of a risk for you to be like going from 0 to 4 days of intense biking versus 0 to 4 days of intense running. Like that person's breaking down 100%. Shin splint, knees, feet, hips, gone. But biking, you know, more like on a systemic fatigue level, probably screwed. But I think, doing too much too fast is one potential thing if you're the kind of person who does too much too fast. On the other side of the spectrum, like you and I would be sitting here, it's like, hey, Brian, let's say you have let's say you're lifting 2 times a week. And I'm like, what's something, I'll just put you on the spot. You're lifting 2 times a week. What is something that person absolutely needs to do to make the most of those 2 days?
The 2 days lifting?
Yeah. Hypothetical, just a separate question. Hey, I'm only lifting 2 days. Like what's some advice?
Not to do with hybrid training, just to do with the lifting days.
Just lifting. Just what would you tell me about those sessions? I'm only doing 2 of them. What would you tell me about them?
Yeah, I would say that you probably should either do 2 full body sessions, or if your cardio modality is very leg dominant, you may consider having 1 full body session and 1 upper body day.
Well, okay. The answer I was looking for was they got to be really fucking hard because you're not doing that much, right? Like you're only doing 2 days. Like nobody's really like, all right, you're doing 2 days of training. Nobody's like, well, we really got to focus on RIR. It's like, no. Like if you can break this down to the most extreme example of just 1 day, imagine you lifted 1 day. Guess what we're doing? To failure, beyond failure, partials, mile reps, drop sets, breaking you down, murdering you. Cause we need to maximize stimulus. We don't need to worry about fatigue. Fatigue will just in 1 day, it's never going to be an issue. So hybrid's tricky because you're not just doing cardio or doing lifting, but I do find, and you said this, and I've taken the long way around here, which is like, if you're, and I don't want to poo-poo this, but let's say you're only doing 2 days of cardio and 3 days of lifting. Like, I'm not so sure you need to be like, well, I heard zone 2 is super important. I got to do zone 2. Right. It's like, well, you're actually probably not maximizing the per minute stimulus and adaptation if you're doing very low intensity. You know, I'll tell you right now, I have 3.5 days of lifting and 3.5 days of cardio. Just like I run on, you know, whatever. I'm just doing every other day with a day off whenever I feel like I need it. And I probably do 1 zone 2 day every other week. And I have 2 days that are more moderate intensity, and then usually 1 day that's on the higher intensity side. And I think that that's because I'm doing 90 minutes of, you know, 120 to 150 minutes of cardio per week. And so I think people hear about polarized training. I think people hear about, you know, 80% of your cardio should be low intensity. And it's like, well, 80% of your cardio should be low intensity if you're doing 20 hours a week of cardio. So I don't, but if, you know, it's funny, I'm still working with Alex. If Alex was sitting here, he'd be like, yes, but you know, we're also dealing with people that don't always have their like recovery optimized. And so you might still be talking about a Gen Pop person who doesn't sleep really well, doesn't have the best nutrition, and they might still benefit from still having a low intensity day just to cater a little bit to maybe not having the best recovery. So I think people just like default to be like, oh, I got to do a lot of zone two. It's like, you got to do a lot of zone two if you're training 20 hours a week. If not, you can probably get a little bit better bang for your, you know, 90 minutes a week that you're putting towards cardio with some higher intensity stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree at base level. I think that there's also an argument that because lifting has more of that high intensity, like glycolytic nature to it, that you could argue that you're getting a lot of that from the lifting and therefore you don't need to cross compete for the same resources with your cardio. And thus maybe, you know, 2 1-hour zone two sessions would be potentially more beneficial than spending your time doing higher intensity work. I kind of see benefits to both ways, but that's kind of a new thought that I've had recently.
I don't think you're incorrect where you're saying zone two is probably as a single thing more complementary to the lifting than a zone four session would be. I think zone five sessions are just in this, have to be at some point in the similar bucket to lifting. So when I say high intensity, I would not recommend zone five. I mean, we do it in the group sometimes. We do some bike sprints and it's fun, but yeah, one day of that. Sure. Definitely not leaning heavily on that, but yeah, I would more so meant like, let's say zone three, low zone four.
Yeah.
Certainly
harder
not
harder than your lactate threshold, it's going to be fatiguing, but it's not going to. Yep. Exactly. It's like below your VO2 max, but around your threshold. Yeah. That's good stuff. I mean, that's the painful, brutal 10 minute intervals or whatever.
But isn't that interesting where like that's like the proverbial like no man's land of like not super not sprinting and not zone two. It's like this no man's land of benefit. The irony is like, I did this with Alex. We went through like building a program for somebody who wanted to run a marathon or whatever. And it was like, what am I programming? What buckets do we need to check if we're training 1 day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We went through that whole thing. And it was like, this sort of sub threshold work where you get a really good SFR was like the box that I would probably check first. And then I would add a bunch of low intensity almost on top of that. So that's like the proverbial, like you said, in those like 4 to 12 minute intervals. We're a smidge in the weeds. I think if we're talking beginners here, like just get the fuck out and do something and don't do too much. But, I do think that a lot of people, when they come to me and they want to do some hybrid stuff, they assume we're going to do a lot of low intensity, or they assume we're going to do a lot of like high intensity sprinting. And in reality, it's like, man, you got to, in this like 4 to 12 minute peri threshold, sub threshold range, is a really, really good bang for your buck.
Yeah. Even in the Seiler 80-20 research, his heart rate is like 88 to 92% across those intervals. And so that's like, I consider zone five to be 93% or higher. So during those intervals, like you're actually, it's solidly in like the middle and the middle to top of zone four.
Yeah. I don't know how this would, I guess it would be similar, but I think I would classify zone five as a zone, an intensity with which you fail via neuromuscular fatigue. Like that's like correct. Where it's no longer cardiovascular. Yeah.
Agreed.
Cool. Let's stay on a similar mentality. Somebody said, I have 6 days to exercise. I care about lifting and cardio equally, which I really appreciate that piece of context, because we would have just led with that. What are the big boxes I should check? I mean, that's a kind of it's a little bit open-ended here, but you care about them equally. So let's, I don't know. Would you say, okay, we're going 3 and 3 then? Do you feel like it would be slightly different?
I feel like I'd love to know if we could throw some double days in there too.
Yeah. 3 sessions of each, let's say. Well, you said 6 days to exercise. Right. So
you said 6 days, which means there could be like potential for them to stack the sessions and have like a lifting day plus a zone two or a lifting day plus a zone four. I don't know. Because I think if you care maximally about both, I don't think doing 3 and 3 is going to maximally get you both. My inclination, if it was 3 and 3, would honestly be to probably do 2 lifting sessions and 4 cardios, because I think that you need a higher dose of cardio to get the adaptation, and the lifting, I think you can still make progress if you're doing it well and with enough volume 2 days a week. So that would be my initial thoughts on the setup. Obviously, if you're lifting 2 days a week, there's certain caveats that you need to take with the intensity, the volume, the exercise selection, things like that, to the point that those sessions might actually obstruct some of your cardio work. So then you have to be careful about where you're putting your cardio around your lifting sessions. 3 and 3 is a great setup. That's mostly what you're doing, like you said, every other day. And how has that been for you? Because I do a lot of double days, and I'm curious about the recovery aspect of, you know, single days from both the psychological side and the physical side.
Yeah, I'm actually at this moment just like allergic to 2 days. Like I just can't. I don't know. I just don't have. I think it's. I'm telling you. I'm going to sound like the biggest little baby here, but I think it's the heat is just killing me, man. Like I just. I'm like hot and sweaty and disgusting and on average more fatigued than normal. Obviously, like a new baby is throwing a wrench in the fatigue side things too. But like I have just enough in me to get through a decent session once per day. Ironically, today I'm going to do a 2 a day. That actually, there's a question on here that says, do you absolutely need to take rest days? So let's kind of talk about, you know, and Alex and I have had these discussions too, where it's like, well, at what point are... So how much of a non-negotiable is it for you to have X amount of rest days? I'll throw that over to you, because I know you're training. Let's say we're both training in a way where I could have more rest days and I could survive 2 days. I totally could. I really need two days off per week. Cool. Let's say I'm training 7 days a week. Let's make that up. Like, this is an interesting thing. I know we've talked about it a little bit, but like if I'm training 7 days a week, am I recovering better? Air quote consolidating stressors, or is it just mostly a work to rest ratio on average? Is there a personal preference that's layered over this? Like, do you feel how many rest days are you putting in into your non-negotiable into your life right now? And how many 2 a days is that costing you?
Yeah, I have basically no set rest days, but it usually ends up that I end up taking one once per week, maybe. But even on that day that I would call a rest day, I'm still either doing 12 to 15,000 steps and or taking a 45 minute bike ride where my heart rate is under 100 or around 100 beats per minute, like similar, like it would be to a really brisk walk or something like that. And so that would be my rest day. I very few times, like usually when I'm traveling or something and I can't get more movement in, do I take like an actual proper rest day. But I mean, even on that day, like I feel like 12,000 steps is just natural, and I wouldn't know how to live my day without doing that. So I consider that a rest day, but I think that's only a rest day because of how active I am the rest of the week. Like my wife hasn't actually done a weight workout or like a hard Peloton in a few days. She's been getting her steps in, but she feels like she hasn't worked out, because you create that setup around your life where you work out every day. So yeah, for me, like that's my story. I have probably 2 double days in a week. I'm doing cardio 5 times a week and lifting 2 to 3 times a week. So yeah, there's a couple double days in there.
How are you structuring your 2 a days?
Personally, I always prefer to put the zone 2 sessions on the same day as a weight workout. I think physiologically, I think the argument is actually better to put your higher intensity stuff on the weight days, because then you bucket stress and you could have a day where you're just doing zone 2, where I feel like the stress component is significantly lower. But psychologically, I can't, like, I feel like lifting and VO2 max or threshold style workouts consume the same sort of place in my brain, and I don't have the bandwidth to do 2 of those in a day.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Physiologically, I think that there's discussions here, but like if I'm going to do a 2 a day, that's how I feel about it too. Are you're doing lifting in the morning? Are you doing them back to, because it also matters, like, are we doing these 6 hours apart? If it is 6 hours apart, yeah I think no longer, you know, you could still say it's still more consolidated to do a heavy leg session and sprints later in the day. That's still more consolidated than not doing that. But like you've separated them far enough that maybe there's less of a worry about what you've paired. They're not really paired together anymore insofar as they're on the same day, you know?
Yeah, they're like I'll lift in the morning at 8 or 9 a.m. and then I'll bike around 1. So I would say there's like 3 hours in between with a meal, you know?
Yeah. I am saying this on the podcast for the first time, but I officially would do the opposite these days. And I say that mostly because, like, so today I did, so let's say a straight up threshold workout, like the real, like, okay, so what I've learned from my own routine is like, working like right at or slightly above threshold is like the most painful place to be. Like there's something about going north of that where things are just over quicker. There's something working slightly under threshold where the intervals are so long that they can be a little daunting. But right at threshold just like fucks me up. And that's what I did this morning. But I still feel like it's not that I care more about the cardio, although that's an argument in itself. I might actually care more about it. If I could only do one session today, I might just do my run. But I'm more likely to, if I separate them by a lot, like you're doing 3 hours apart. If I was doing like this workout I just did and then 3 hours later you had told me I had to lift, unless I had like another double espresso shot of liquid courage in me, but separating them by a long time, I think I'm in a state where I'm doing my lifts later because I can. Because if you're like, oh, I have fucking laying down princess headrest, cable laterals, and like leg extension, and split squat maybe thrown in there, which is emotionally more taxing, but like usually three upper body lifts that cause me no emotional stress whatsoever. One lower body exercise causes me no emotional stress. It could be like a leg extension, ham curl, calf raise, a glute med kickback. And then maybe at most one leg exercise, which is like, oh yeah, fuck, I got to mentally gear up for this hack squat or RDL or split squat. Just I'm in a place right now where I feel like you can get me to do that on when I'm more fatigued than you can get me to. Mm-hmm. I've had some really shit runs in the afternoon as well. I've had some real shit runs where I'm like, I just don't have it. I just don't have it. And I feel like I could maybe muster up a lift in a better state.
I feel like running is a piece of that. Running just is just more destructive to the body. And so after you've lifted, it feels more burdensome on the body for sure. And then what was the other thing I was going to say? You're talking about doing two high intensity sessions. So you're like at threshold and you're lifting. Those are two, again, like not the same energy system, but consume like similar resources, glucose dominant. And for my zone two, being on a bike, it's just, you and I've talked about this. I just love my zone two sessions and I don't feel like they're fatiguing. I don't feel like they're tiring. I literally like enjoy being outside. And there's also something to, you live in the South in the summer and it's the middle of the day.
It's fucking gross.
And I live in Colorado where there's no humidity and the bike also moves faster, which creates more wind flow. So, I mean, there's so many factors that go into that, but I do relate to what you're saying as well.
I was listening to a guy on a podcast. So there's a question on here that, I'll ask you, which ironically, I think they meant you. Do you have any interest in the Tour de France? I know you gravel bike. It's not necessarily the same thing, but ironically, there was a gravel tour this year in the tour. Any interest? Anything that like your biking has brought you to be like, oh yeah, that's intriguing. I might follow that.
I am intrigued by it, and I didn't follow it at all.
Cool.
And that was mostly a result of just my life. Like I even saw you on your story post be like Tour de France, and I'm getting nothing done today or whatever. And I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. It sucks that I have so much work to do. So I definitely like think about it, and then I subscribe to Velo, and they send me daily updates of what happened in the tour. So I've literally been reading every single one of the Velo news briefs of the day, so I know what's happening. Yeah. I've seen 0 minutes of actual coverage live.
So my dad's a big fan and it's as like a father son way to connect with him. Like he's just from the Netherlands. Like in Europe, it's a big deal. Like him and his dad would like watch a tour that, they started in the Netherlands one time. So they would go out and they watch it. And so been trying really hard to get into it. Actually, like it's challenging to get into because it's not the American way of racing. It's where it's like, oh, it's just me versus you and we run and who's faster wins. And it's one day and one race. It's like, there are a bunch of teams and it's fucking 21 days. And so I wanted to spit some numbers at you just cause you and I have, you will understand what I'm about to say. And so, whatever, I'll give you the basics. There's two dudes who are amazing in the last 4 years. When the podcast with Atiyah and Inigo?
Yeah, Pogacar.
So Pogacar won 3 years ago, and then the last 2 years, this other guy, Jonas Vingegaard, won. And this year, this past May, Vingegaard got into almost died in an accident. He got into a crazy accident. So going into this race, he was seen as probably not fit enough to beat Pogacar. But they were neck and neck going into this past weekend, and it was the biggest day of climbing this Sunday. And what ended up happening is they were neck and neck for the first, for the first 90% of the race. And then somebody makes a move and they try and win. And Vingegaard made a move and he hit 7.3 watts per kilo 5 hours into a race for 13 minutes. And
it's insane.
And Pogacar smoked him. And it was the great, I get goosebumps because it was the greatest performance ever seen. So Pogacar went to, basically it was like normalized for like 7.75 watts per kilo normalized at sea level. Because they're going up an 8.4% grade and they're in the, like in the mountains.
Right.
And he got absolutely smoked at, he was going, and it, they are saying that if that, that was the craziest attack ever made, this guy going 7.4 watts per kilo for 13 minutes, 24 seconds. And the fact that he got smoked was just like the craziest thing ever. And putting those numbers on it, like you're, what are you, 80, not 85 kilos, something like that. I don't know.
87, something like that. Yeah.
That's like what, 560, you know, let's say 600 watts for 13 minutes. And that's, I don't know what you, so it's tricky. I use an Echo bike. So the numbers are not the same. You're on an actual bike. Can you speak to how insane that is? And not only insane, but that's 5 hours into a grueling race in the heat of summer. Like, could you keep up 600? Could you keep up? Yeah. 600 watts for any length of time?
My VO2 max, what I can hold for 7 minutes is 300 watts.
Holy fucking shit.
That's my 7 minutes power.
Well, that's awesome. And that's awesome. And then,
so I can hold 600 watts for about 10 or 15 seconds. It's a sprint essentially.
Ah, so crazy. It's just I was trying to put it into perspective because I was like, you know, I can keep that up on a bike for, I can keep up on the Echo bike. Echo bike, you could obviously do way more output. You could put way more output. But yeah, I thought, maybe next year, when next year rolls around, I'll give you some material. Because I think, and something that I really wish they would start to do in the tour is have more data on screen. So when they're like showing Pogacar, I want to see his watts. I want to see the watts he's putting out in that moment. I want to see the calculated watts per kilo, and I want to see his heart rate. And I want they have that data. So I just think that they would make everybody watching the tour who's a bike nerd is using those pieces of data and would be just fascinated to see it. Some people are claiming that Pogacar is on the juice. Like, he's putting out numbers that are just absolutely insane. Yeah, everybody's on the juice. Everyone's EPOing. Everyone's doing these blood transfusions and shit. But yeah, crazy.
Cool. Yeah, or he's just got Inigo as his coach.
And the UAE team is crazy too. Yeah, it's all that zone too. I mean, I'm sure their training is elite. Cool. All right. Have any of you ever had any health scares or bad blood markers that made you change certain things?
No, I mean, honestly, my blood has been, knock on wood, really solid for most of my life. The only negative really that I've ever been dealing with was low testosterone, and I've never really done anything about it. It's never been low enough that it scared me per se. Like, it always hovered right around the like just under 300 mark. And then most recently it was back up into the mid to high 300s. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's just been that way for a really long time, and I don't really notice any effects from it. So, no, I can't say I have. I feel very lucky because diabetes runs in my family, but like my mom said, like, I'm not them. Different humans, different lifestyle. And then my dad has high blood pressure. Mine's been right around the 120 over 80, maybe slightly below, but it's not like a lot below. So I do keep an eye on it just to make sure that it doesn't climb. LDL cholesterol stuff's always been good for me. So that's super lucky. How about you?
Yeah. And it's nice that, so you, in some ways, things can happen to us and they make us make a positive change. And in your circumstance, like in a perfect world, you actually don't have bad things happen to you, and you can learn from like things that have happened to others or others are dealing with. Like, that's probably has less of a downside. I'm curious about the low T. Let's stay on that for a sec. So you were sub 300. Did you, at the time in which you found that out, were you curious about that? Or was that like an, oh shit, like I don't feel like a low T person, you know? Or, and then when you did get that number, did you think, oh, I should do something about that? And did you try anything?
So the first time I ever got my T tested was in 2014 when I was in the heart of competitive CrossFit, and I was training 18 hours a week or something crazy like that. And the number was 330. I was 32 years old at that point. And so 330 didn't actually flag anything. That was in the normal range. It was just like they didn't even mention it in the consult when they went over my blood work afterwards. It was just like ignored as they kind of were like, this is fine. This is fine. Okay. That's one thing, blah, blah, whatever.
But as a meathead, you're probably thinking testosterone matters. I see that number reference range, maybe up to 1,000. It's on the low end. Did it make you feel anything, or were you like, hey, they said it's fine. I'm fine. I'm healthy. I'm fit. I'm, you know, whatever.
It was that mostly, and then my assumption that it was mostly a result of the overtraining from CrossFit. Like I was aware that I was overtrained. I had also been on, actually, when we talk about health scare, that's actually, so here we go. I have a good health scare. They said blood work, and I got uber focused on the blood work. In 2012, I had a DVT in my calf, a blood clot. And it was super surprising because I'm a young, healthy guy running a CrossFit gym. But as I kind of assess what was going on in my life at that point, I was in the first year or two of opening a gym. I was sleeping almost none. I think I averaged 6 hours of sleep a night for an entire year. And so I was consuming Adderall to get through the day and then not being able to sleep because I had consumed too much Adderall. And I was also training 18 hours a week. So then, boom, my calf blows up, super swollen. I don't know what's going on. We think it's a Baker's cyst. It turns out it's not. Turns out it's a blood clot. I go on blood thinners. And then literally I was on blood thinners for 9 months. And then that test that I took was maybe 6 months after that. So I assumed with the blood clot, the blood thinners, the lifestyle I was living with CrossFit, the Adderall, like, I mean, all of these things coming together, I was like, makes sense. My testosterone's low. Like, I probably just needed to just clean that up. I didn't have another blood test again until maybe even like 2019. So I was well out of the CrossFit. I was into the hypertrophy world. And at that point, my testosterone was still around the same. It was like 279 or something like that. And it just kind of hovered around that level for a while. And I did consider at that point being like, should I consider? Well, I thought TRT might be a good thing to do, but I was concerned because I also had visions of potentially competing in natural bodybuilding. And so I figured I would hold off on it and just try to see if it would change over time, not do anything about it. Then it was maybe like a year or two later that Ben House went on the Iron Culture podcast and had his big like two or three hour episode where he talked all about TRT and how it's being misprescribed and how like 80%+ of people that go on TRT end up taking themselves off of it within the first year because of negative side effects or it not doing what they want it to do. And so all of those things kind of came together and I was like, look, I'm still not even 40 years old at that point. I'm not going to go on TRT. I'm just going to, like, I don't feel like I have low testosterone. So if the symptoms aren't there, why am I going to do anything about it? And then in my most two recent tests, it's been back up into like the high 300s. So it seems like it's not decreasing. In fact, it's going up and I feel great. So I really don't question it anymore.
Yeah. That's the, intelligent way to go about it. Certainly not a thing that's, clinical. It's more symptom. So if you're like, hey, that indicates potential symptoms. Okay, fine. But if you're like, I don't have those symptoms. I mean, I'm not gonna lie to you. I did a blood test by, a name that people would know, like the company. And, my test came back 560, which, by the way, hand on heart, highest it's ever been. I've had tests in the 200s before when I was like mega, mega lean, didn't eat 1 gram of fat per day. I was eating like just chicken, rice, and broccoli like an idiot, 5%, you know, whatever, between 5% and 8% body fat trying to walk around like that year round. Test crashed. And so I was 560. I'm stoked. Best it's ever been. Feel amazing. All good. And like, it was like, they were like nervous to tell me that because of how much they think I should go on TRT and how much they pushed TRT to me after that number. By the way, no discussion of symptoms at all. Like nobody asked me like, oh yeah, but like how's libido and how's motivation and how's muscle gain? And like, and nobody said anything about that. It was just like, dude, your test is 560. Like you could feel better. And I was like, wait, what? Like, that was fucking crazy stuff.
You're like right in the middle of it. You're like literally right in the middle. Crazy. It's like, oh, your HbA1c is 5.2. You're almost diabetic. You should probably get on insulin.
Nuts. The one blood marker for me that is I did like 9 months strict keto back like in 2013, 2014 or something. And I had LDL like high 300s. At that point, I didn't know enough to get ApoB done, but I could imagine it was through the roof as well. and spent a lot of time undoing that, and happily, you know, LDL is fantastic. ApoB is fantastic. And I'm super pumped about that. Just as a marker of, I don't want to see that go up. And it just pains me to see like the keto carnivore scenario where like, I felt, yeah, whatever, not to go on a high horse here, but you don't feel that. You don't feel that your cholesterol is super high. You don't feel that you're trending towards cardiovascular disease. That's not like a thing you feel. It's happening in the background. It's like life, LDL years, is what I would lean on now. So that is something I guess I harp on either directly or indirectly quite a bit here. What is your go-to pre-workout meal? Or do you even have one?
Cardio or weights, you know, maybe both. Yeah. So for weights, I almost always begin my lift fasted, but immediately upon warming up, I begin sipping on my protein Gatorade mixture. Yeah. Which Jordan got to, did you get to try my Gatorade mixture? Yeah, Jordan liked it.
Delicious.
Fantastic. Delicious. So I'll do that and then I'll finish it by the time my workout is over, and that has like 50 grams of protein, 50 grams of carbs in it. And that usually is pretty good for me. I don't really overstress it too much. For biking, I do generally feel like having some food in me prior is important, especially for a higher intensity, like threshold session. So my general go-to is the thing that I almost always eat all the time throughout the day is just chicken teriyaki with white rice and maybe some broccoli. And so that, that meal goes in me, and then within 30 minutes, I'll be on my bike using all that glucose that I just ate.
You'll go 30 minutes after that meal and you'll hop on the bike?
Yeah.
Yo, savage. If I even feel like 1 ounce of food in me when I go out for a run, I'm like, that's it. I'm sloshing.
But running's different. Running's different, man. It's just different. I agree that I can't really go out running 30 minutes after that meal either. You feel it like sloshing around inside of you as you bounce from foot to foot. There's no bouncing in biking. You're stable. And I actually can feel the energy from the food. It's almost like it's seeping out of my belly, like into my legs. It's like the weirdest feeling. I'm like, oh my God, I'm amazing. I'm superhero. So that really does good things for me. Sometimes when I'm going out for zone two rides, I'll just make that same mixture, that Gatorade whey thing. And I'll put it in a Camelback, and it'll be the same thing. I'll be like, hey, I'm doing zone two. It's low effort. I'll just start sipping on it whenever I start riding and just kind of sip on it casually throughout the ride.
Yeah. I don't have a go-to pre-workout meal, but I certainly like, I've been one to very much like poo-poo the relevance of this for most people. Like, it's just like most people are doing 60 minute like hypertrophy session, not fucking 3 hour bike ride. And you know, but I will say I prefer working out fed. I have nothing against training fasted. And when I'm going out for a very early morning run, I'm doing it fasted. I don't care about even like remote fractions of percents better that I would get if I was fed. It's like, I need to get out before it's 90 and humid. And so that is what it is. But I do prefer training fed. And so I don't have a pre-workout meal. I just have an ode to making sure that I'm digested enough. And so for you, like in that bike scenario, you were like, well, I'm good 30 minutes after. So you've chosen the food that you're eating, but you've also very much decided how long after that do I need to then get into what I'm doing. That's more of what I think about. I don't care about exactly. All of my meals are like, for the most part, air quote, balanced meals. And so like, you know, some carbs, some protein, some fat, some fiber. And so I'm thinking a little bit more about how long after this am I going to train? Not necessarily about exactly what meal components I'm having. It's just more about like, I'm going to train at, today I ran at 8:30. And so I pushed breakfast up and I ate, you know, whatever. I got up at 5:45 and just to do whatever. So I don't really have a pre-workout meal that I go to, but I do think when you're thinking about pre-workout meal, I'm way more concerned with you thinking about how long you have before training and that deciding what sort of meal you should be eating.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. What else do we have? I think we have one more here. Yeah. I know you're both into efficient style training. What's something you do in your own training that you really value to save time or be more efficient? I think there's a lot of things that we both do, but I'm trying to think of maybe something that you do and isn't in the most obvious thing. Like, hey, let's make sure we take our sets a little closer to failure, compounds, lengthened position. What's something that's maybe, come on, give the people a little
circuit exclusive style training.
Yeah, like circuit. That. Talk a little bit about that.
my lower body day now also has delts and arms on it. So literally I have one quad movement, one hamstring movement, one delt, one bicep, one tricep movement. And I'll just literally go through in a circuit. I'll actually start by just alternating the quad and the ham, and I'll warm both of those up sufficiently because they take a lot longer. And then once I actually get into my work sets for those movements, then I'll kind of start warming up my upper body movements and get into those, because I'll only do like two or three sets of the upper body stuff, but I'm doing like five sets of the lower body stuff. So that's my lower body day. And so that just circuit, man, it just works perfectly because lower body movements are so demanding that having that break in between to go do some upper body stuff is actually allows you to recover. Like, my heart rate doesn't get super high. We had a question about this in the group the other day. And someone was like, what does your heart rate get to when you're lifting? And it's obviously dependent on the movement, but I actually get up to like 160, 170 for lower body compounds. And then for chins and dips, I'll get into like the 150s because they're super demanding, but almost anything else below chins and dips, even upper body compounds where you're like back supported or anything like that, I'm good like under 130 usually. So if I'm doing upper body movements that are isolation, my heart rate might not even get above 115. So I'm sitting there doing those movements, recovering, go back to the leg work. That works out perfectly. My other training day that's not lower body with delts and arms is chest and back. And so I do the same thing there where I just alternate movements back and forth, warm each other up, and then get into work sets. I can get through my chest and back workout in like 40 minutes now.
That only increases efficiency if by doing that, you've shrunk the rest periods. If you're like, people are like, hey, I'm doing circuit training. It's like, I do the hack and then 4 minutes, and then I do pushups and then 4 minutes and then I do bicep curls. Right. Like, yeah, but that's not making it more efficient. You're using a circuit style approach so that you can rest a smidge less between things.
Yeah. Quite a bit less, I would say, even like to have to warm up all the upper body movements after doing all the lower body movements just adds so much time, but a warm up set on upper body is no effort. So literally as I'm resting, like I actually might rest less when I do that because I just am in this habit of staying moving. And when I sit, I tend to sit longer. And so just this idea of it's okay that I'm training with my heart rate at 110 instead of at 90 when I start a set, it just almost feels more fluid that way too.
Yeah. And I think the one that came to mind to me, both of these are kind of home gym related. Like, you know, you probably can't do that in a big box gym for sure. You can't just like cycle through, which whatever, if you're a home gym, you should do that. The other one for home gym is setting up the workout the night before. So just like getting the bench and the cable height and the set up the hack and put your warm up weight on the rack. If you're doing RDLs, whatever. I think that that's a really helpful one.
Yep.
I think one that I've done that I see myself doing is with isolation lifts as a catch-all term for like easy shit. I've been easy stuff that's less likely to be limited by cardio, less likely to be limited by synergist, like very just like, hey, it's a bicep curl. Like, you know, it's like not really going to fail for any other way, is really leaning on lower rest periods. Like the ultimate low rest period is just myo reps. And so I've just thought to myself, well, if myo reps are a logical way to do this, then what if I just put another 15 seconds on that? I do 30 seconds, I do 45 seconds or 60 seconds. It's all logical, so long as I accumulate enough sets. And I think the less rest you do, the more likely you should just layer on, you should round up the amount of stuff you're doing. And so it's like, yeah, do I get my best performance with 3 minutes bicep curls? Fine. But like, if I'm a little pressed for time, all right, maybe I do one extra set, but we only rest 30 seconds, or we, you know, rest 15 seconds, or we just myo rep things. And I think that I think you could take that a little bit too far. But I always think like myo reps are logical. I've had my group, we did 60 second rest for bicep curls. And people were like, why are we doing such short rest? I'm like, nobody said anything when we did myo reps. I had you rest 15 seconds, you know? So you're getting 10, 7, 5, 3. When you were doing myo reps, you were getting 10, 3, 3, 3, 3, and nobody batted an eyelash. So I just think I really have leaned into that. I'm like, God, I'm like emotionally recovered, cardiovascularly recovered. I'm going again. If it's been 40 seconds, we're going.
I use that a lot. Like I'll take like, you know, rest 30 seconds between sets or 40 seconds, expect your reps to drop.
Yes.
And like that, cause it's the expectation I think that gets people, they see 60 seconds and they're like, that feels like it should be full rest, but it's just not. And so they then try to not let the reps drop and they get in their head about it. But as long as you put that little note in, then everyone knows what to expect and it's all good.
Yeah. I actually think those were cycles where I told people not to only track the first set because I just didn't want people focused on that. I think we're doing this cycle some back and forth on unilateral stuff. So like a hammer grip preacher curl, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left. And I think I'm only having people track the first set on each arm because you do the right, then you do the left, then you do the right. But on the right, that time around, you probably didn't do as many reps. So by the time you get to the second set of the left has already begun to get less rest. And so it's not like you're going to get 8-8, 6-6, 4-4. It's going to be like 8-8, 6-4, 4-3. And it's just all of a sudden the left arm has kind of gotten screwed. And so it's like, I really just like, I want you guys tracking stuff and working hard. And so, that's definitely one that if you can get out of your head about that stuff, it all works fine. But sometimes, you know, it's difficult. All right. But we're coming up on an hour, man. You got things to do. You probably have a bike or a lift or something coming up.
I haven't exercised yet today. I got my podcast done first.
Nice. Cool. What's going on with anything you guys want to drop about Paragon? Tell people about your new hybrid programming, stuff like that.
We're in the middle of a new cycle. I don't know when this is coming out. It started July 15th, but it's combining some running or biking and rowing and stuff in a structured manner with some metabolic style hypertrophy training. So, nice.
Cool.
Good stuff.
Check it out if you want some hybrid stuff. And we got to get off the same. You can't start the program same time I'm starting, but we got to stagger these things. Ruth starts next week.
We did get off schedule for a while because we did a 20-week hypertrophy cycle.
Nice.
And so we had to have gotten off, and then I don't know how we got back on again.
Cannibalizing, man. Can't be doing this. So. All right. Cool, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.